And this is talking with Dr. Rosen at Jodrell Bank on 12th August, 1976.
Yes, to the 12th. Yes, that's right.
Now, you started as a student at Jodrell Bank. And what year was that?
As a PhD student.
Right.
Oh, 1954, perhaps, something like that.
Right. And what was your undergraduate major?
In physics, in honors physics, at Manchester.
Right.
I did my first year under Blackett, and then he left for London at the end of my first year. That I am quite sure of.
Right.
So if you want to tie the date exactly, that is right. Okay. I'm not sure about the 1954 when I came here, something like that.
Okay. And so you came to Jodrell Bank in 54, 55.
Yes.
What was the atmosphere that you found as a...
What was the atmosphere? Well, of course, it was a place where I think people had tended to have their own experiment. I'm trying to think now, you know, how it differs from what it is now. And then it was much earlier. The subject was much earlier. The experiments were much more self-contained. The time scale was different. People spent a long time doing PhDs and really sort of took their time over it. They started building up their own equipment and did the experiment and analysed it and wrote it up and published it, all on a much longer time scale
than
now. Now we really are constrained to get people through in not much more than 3 years.
Hmm. Wow.
But,
and then what was the average time?
Oh, it must have been something like 5 years or perhaps more. So things had differed in scale. The scale was smaller, you know, quantity of equipment, complexity. The time scale was longer. That's the simple concept.
Was this because there just was not so much competition in the world, you think, or...?
Why should the timescale have been different? That's a good question. I think that grants were easy to come by. Postgraduate grants were comparatively easy to come by, and there wasn't the sort of pressure on us to get a lot of students through. Mm-hmm. Now I feel there is a certain amount of sort of pressure to you know, just to reckon our what the government would call our cost effectiveness.
Right. And throughput.
That's right. Throughput of students and is something which grant giving bodies tend to sort of monitor now in a way they didn't.
Would you say that the feeling you have for competition was different then than now? I know there was quite a bit then, but was it less or more than now?
I was less aware of it. But I don't think that I bothered about it in these days. I was less aware of it, but what the actual situation is, I wouldn't like to say.
So what happened to you as a student? When a first-year student arrives, how did he get shunted to one
college or another? I think I was perhaps a bit of an exception. I think normally a student possibly would have joined somebody a bit older in the establishment. But I was much of an exception. I was Lovell's research student.
Mm-hmm.
At a time when he was much tied up with the politics of building Mark One.
Right.
And so he warned me I would be left to myself a great deal, and so it was. I had a great deal of help from other senior staff in a sort of informal sort of way, but to a large extent I was left to myself to get on with it.
Which people do you mean were you to get help from?
Oh, Hanby Brown, when he was here. But he seemed to be sort of knocking around quite a bit, probably associated with the Mark One politics. Roger Jennison was very helpful to me at that stage too.
Well, why did Lovell take you on? Was it a topic that he was interested in?
It was a topic he was interested in, that's right.
And what was the topic?
Well, when I first arrived at Jodrell, publication had just occurred in which people had detected Cassiopeia Cygnus Taurus at a wavelength of 10.7 centimetres, or perhaps it wasn't 10.7, it was perhaps 9.4 to be honest. Anyway, it was Haddock.
NRL, right.
NRIO, that's right, 50 foot dish.
NRL.
NRL, sorry, right. It's a bigger problem. NRL, yes. Had first detected these sources at centimetre wavelengths.
Right.
So there was an obvious hole there in our information, in our knowledge. Was the diameter of these sources going to be the same? That is radically different. So the diameter had only been measured at sort of meter. Was the diameter going to be the same at 10 centimeters?
Which was another way of asking, perhaps, is the spectral index constant across the source?
That's what we'd now say. I don't think we said that at the time. No, we didn't think of it that way. I think in a sort of, one might almost say, mystical sort of way, we said that you've got something like Cygnus, which, for those photographs, looked like just a little galaxy. But the radio shape was much bigger, two big blobs, right outside.
Right.
And so we tended to draw a sort of, as it were, straight line between them as a working hypothesis. Does the diameter just simply change linearly the frequency?
Yes. Right.
Does it just scale smoothly down into the optical source? I think that's...
At a higher frequency, you were thinking it might be smaller than...
That's what I expected.
Millimeters yet smaller.
It was a very naive thing of me, but that's what I expected.
Yes, very interesting. Now, this business about Cygnus being a double source, this was accepted that there was no doubt that this was correct.
We were quite convinced it was a double source.
Right, but this was not generally true outside of John Williams, I believe.
That may well have been. We were using these, it was Jennison's interferometer, I think, that showed that Cygnus was a double source. I think we filmed it, because there was a second maximum in the Fourier transform, and that second maximum was just too big.
Right.
There's no other reasonable source distribution that could give you such a big second maximum. So we believe this.
Okay, so you started on this 10.7 centimeters.
That's right.
And were there any special technical difficulties?
Yes, very much so. In fact, that's what I spent much of my time overcoming. Basically, the problems with local oscillator, I think, that people knew how to build a simple S-band receiver using a Klastron local oscillator, and then you just mix it out to 13 megs in my case, actually, oddly enough. And everybody knew how to do that. But what people couldn't do with the equipment available at the time, the simple thing would have been to have just two aerials, it had to be 100 yards or more apart. The simple approaches would have been to use travelling wave tubes, I suppose, or waveguide to bring these two signals together at signal frequency. But we just didn't have the hardware to hand, and it would have been too expensive to have a run of waveguide 100 yards long.
Mm-hmm.
Or to use the necessary number of travelling wave tubes to overcome the attenuation in coaxial cable. All this would have been just too expensive. So we had to find another way around, and the only way around we could see was to use coherent local oscillators, two separate mixes of the two ends and coherent local oscillators. And the only local oscillators we had were Klastrons, so the problem boiled down to how to synchronize Klastrons. And that was the first project I got underway on. Was literally synchronizing Klastrons, trying to get them to lock exactly the same frequency, and you'll find the first chapter or so in my thesis, I think, is talking about properties of locked Klastrons like that, just by feeding a bit of one Klastron into the other.
Right.
And the outcome of all that was that it wasn't going to be reliable enough. The
flexibility just was not
to... Yeah, it tended to jump out of lock, for one thing. For another thing, I think we also knew that we were not going to have total power stability. I was thinking of Lovell's idea was, let's have the simplest equipment we can have. And I quite agree with him, of course. That's always a good starting point.
Yeah.
Could we just have a total power? Well, by the time we'd got to asking this question, I already had a single total power, 10.7 centimeters.
By total power, you mean an intensity interferometer, a Henry round twist?
Oh, no, I mean a single dish.
Oh, you mean a single dish?
And that was the first thing I built up, was a single dish, total power.
But not interferometer.
Not interferometer.
Yeah.
Sorry, I slipped the word interferometer in by mistake. No, just a single dish and total power system to check its stability. I could see the sun, but I couldn't see anything else because of total power instability, which was mainly caused by, I think, the crystal mixers we were using in those days when it was stable.
There was no sort of switching, no load switching.
There was no load switching at that stage. So the interferometer obviously wasn't going to work if we just used the total power interferometer because of instability. We'd have to use some sort of phase switching or load rotating. That was one factor.
So you were thinking perhaps of trying to use the Henry round twist interferometer.
And therefore I started
even at this higher frequency. But
yes.
But of course its real strength is only when you have a high ratio of source noise to system noise. And this certainly wouldn't be true at these high frequencies.
No, it was all system noise dominated entirely, yes.
Right.
Right, I think we're talking across purposes here. I beg your pardon, I should have written that up. You talk about Hanby-Brown and twists.
Right.
And there is also the Hanby-Brown and Thompson lobe rotating system.
Oh, that's what you were talking about.
That's what I was meant to be talking about. And so it's the Hanby, you're quite right, the Hanby-Brown and twist system. Well, some people did try and mention it to me. But as you pointed out, it depends on the source noise dominated setup. So it wouldn't have worked. We could soon put the Hanby-Brown and twist wouldn't work in this context. Now, what I aimed to use was the Henry Bowne, Palmer and Thompson low budget system. And then eventually I could see I could kill two birds with one stone. The one unsatisfactory thing was total bastability, the other was that these plastrons wouldn't really lock all that well. So then I killed two birds with one stone by running the two plastrons 20 kilohertz apart. And then you could use one plastron as a double local oscillator. One local oscillator just went into the radio astronomy receiver. The other local oscillator went into a local oscillator receiver. In the split part. And the local oscillator receiver had an IF of 20 kilohertz. And received the distant plastron. You could radiate the energy from the distant plastron. And make quite a sensitive receiver. So you could either have radiation through 4-foot dishes, or send the signal down quite lossy cables.
And which did you finally do?
Well, the cable or the dish? I used the cables for short baseline and a pair of 4-foot dishes for the long baselines. So it just depends on the baseline I think to do.
Now, am I correct in thinking that this indeed was the highest frequency that anybody had tried an interferometer?
At that time, yes. Conway, I think, published something at about 400 megs before I did, or about the time I published.
So that's a big jump. It was a factor 10.
That's right. It was a factor of 10 in observing frequency. So I was thrown in the deep end. Now that's the good equipment. 10 times the working frequency. Previously used. I left myself to get on with it.
Okay.
that's not quite true, but... Were
there other problems in getting this thing going that you haven't mentioned? Before you got to some astronomy.
I think the other problem... I had to effectively build my own dishes. The bigger dish we had. And the original plan was to use the 25-foot dish to move around the fields. And we were going to build a 50-foot dish as well. But...
Completely movable?
No, the 50-foot dish would have to be used as a transit instrument. It would have been an iron framework just lying on the ground and jacked up to look at different elevations. That was the original, different declinations. So look at different declinations and observe only in transit. That was the plan that I was sort of given to start with. This would have given me a big, a useful signal-to-noise ratio. But I spotted pretty soon on that I would be tied to transit observations. And I didn't like this idea at all. I think it was probably something I picked up from Jennison. I think Jennison must have had the idea that if you could follow the source around the sky, you are getting a lot more information.
Yeah.
Though I don't think Jennison quite knew how to use that information in those days.
You mean in terms of astrosensus, really?
Well, that's what we now call it. Right. The idea was not really in the air, even in those days.
Yeah.
But that's what we now call it. And I really sort of cottoned on to this idea of wanting to follow sources around the sky. So when I first came here, the workshop had already put together for me a 25-foot dish with a wire mesh. The only trouble was it got the shape of a wall.
Yeah, I was going to say, a wire mesh, you have to be a little careful with it.
So that was another one of my first difficulties, was to make this 25-foot dish work. That was the other technical difficulty.
I forget the diameter of it, the one that Rod Davies used for hydrogen line work.
30-foot.
Right, that was that occupied with line observations?
That was occupied with the line observations, and it was thought that I really couldn't use that.
Yeah.
Furthermore, I think it probably only was just about good enough, 21 centimetres. His efficiency would have been quite bad at 10 centimetres. Though incidentally, the 25-foot dish, even when I finished it, was pretty bad at 10 centimetres. So in the end, I used a 25-foot dish. It was a bit stupid. I ended up with a 25-foot dish on a trailer, which I could move around, and I ended up with a 10-foot dish tied down to a concrete block, which I couldn't move.
And their effective area was not too different.
And then in the end, the effective area wasn't too different, because the 10-foot dish was bought from an ex-army store, and really was figured to about 3 centimeters, you see, so that worked top-notch, and the 25-foot dish didn't work quite well. And so I could have probably got back to 10-foot dishes.
But going back to the concept, you said that you did not call it astrosynthesis, so that's certainly true, but nevertheless you were thinking about getting different, what we now call UV spacings, in order to get information about the source extent.
Yes, that's right. And that was my first experiment, as I remember it, and you better check up on the literature.
Well, your first publication is in 57, in a short note of the Proceedings of the Physical Society.
That's right.
Where you say that Taurus has about the same diameters of meter wavelengths and cast is maybe a tad smaller, 20% smaller or something.
That sort of thing, yeah.
Yeah.
And that, I reckon, as I remember, it was done by transit observations and just changing the baseline. Oh, yes, that's right. I'm beginning to remember all the other technical difficulties now. The trouble was delay. That there was this funny thing that using a 13 megahertz IF, I use a 13 megahertz IF because I inherited some 13 megahertz IFs. You see, there's no better reason than that.
Right.
Because it was all done on a shoestring. It was all XR and the equipment. And all the
even at that stage, in the late 50s.
Even in that stage, yeah. Yes. Well, maybe that's not quite true to say it was ex-army equipment. It was equipment that we got from Metrovix, I think, through the old boy network. Some waveguides, fund ends. But, you know, it was sort of not really, not bought properly for the job. It was
right.
Something we sort of
right.
picked up on the side. And this all had 13 MHz.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 13 MHz, with a radio frequency of, what would that be, 2800 megs. 8 gigs, there's no possibility of image rejection.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, not reasonably.
Yeah, right.
So, that meant that I was getting two sets of fringes, fringes from one sideband and fringes from the other sideband. And that meant that the radio frequency bandwidth, before you went into any active electronics, was some 26 megahertz.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had to get all your IF, oddly enough, you had to get all your IF delays accurate to
right.
a 26 meg bandwidth,
mm-hmm.
although the actual bandwidth of the IF itself
yes.
is only about 4 megs.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, right.
So, and this, I proved that this was so in my observations on some spots, just proved that I really did have to get the delay
right.
to a sort of 30 meg bandwidth.
But this was only because you would never design something this way, it's just because you were stuck with...
And just because I was using what I inherited.
Yeah.
So that was another technical difficulty, which sort of frightened me to start with. And so I only did, I think, as far as I remember, I only did transit observations for that first paper.
And why did you not do Cygnus in that first paper? That was really the source of most interest, I would think. Or was that the... which were the sources of most interest, I should let you answer that question.
The answer was that I was prepared to look at anything I could see. I couldn't see very much because of low sensitivity.
And maybe Cygnus is a little bit less than Cass and Taurus at these frequencies.
Cass is
I'm
the strongest,
sure.
undoubtedly.
Yeah. Right.
Taurus is the next strongest and Cygnus is the weakest.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
I think that Cygnus was a bit near the noise for the equipment then, and I did make measurements in Cygnus at that time, but they were a bit doubtful and it was thought best not to publish them. They were a bit unhappy about them. Oh, right, yes, aha. Sorry, I remembered now. They were inconsistent and we didn't know why. And the point was, I was, just the way things happened, the 10-foot dish was out there and the 25-foot dish I towed out into the field. And there were a whole lot of heaps of steelwork.
About how far away was the baseline?
Oh, about as far as those trees, and what's that, 100, 200 yards, that
mm-hmm.
sort of thing.
Okay.
And there was all sorts of heaps of steelwork out in that field, because they were building them out one at a time.
Oh, yeah.
And that meant that what I call an east-west baseline wasn't really quite east-west.
Yeah.
From one length to another, it would be slightly changed orientation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, now we know that Cygnus is elongated, so I must take the projected length of the baseline, projected along the length of the elongation of Cygnus.
Mm-hmm.
And I put this correction in. And then the data I got was obviously not self-consistent. You know, I was not getting a smooth curve through my data box.
That was consistent with Jensen and Dasgupta's
That's right.
results.
Position angle.
Right.
I assumed their position angle. And I could see that my data was not self-consistent, so just put it on one side. I couldn't understand that.
So in this first paper, there's no Cygnus?
So there's no Cygnus because there was an unknown systematic error lurking in the data. And at that stage, I didn't understand it, so I just threw it out.
Was there anyone else that was doing similar work at this time?
I think there was, yes, in France. I don't remember who it was.
In France?
In France, yes.
Gee, I don't know either. I've just been talking with them. On Cygnus, you say?
Yes, I think so. I think he was a bit behind me, and he had some sort of integration technique, so he could get weaker sources, although he only had the same sort of dishes.
I have to think about that. Anyway,
but I don't know how whether anything came out of it, and I think that I was tending to take my time rather, and I think this chap, the existence of this chap, was sort of emphasized, a bit overemphasized to me to make me get a move on. but there was some work in France, and I'm convinced.
Now, in your thesis, in the Monthly Notices article in 59, you did have Cygnus.
That's right.
And I have here that you went up to as much as 3,400 wavelengths.
Yes, more or less not the same place.
And what were the main results of your...
The main result of the Cygnus observations were that the position angle that I got was different from the position angle that Jensen Biscotti got. And that's what was wrong with the earlier measurements I then realized. I had been correcting for the slightly different azimuths at the baseline.
And how different? It was different, roughly.
Oh, gosh, I don't know. It would be in the literature, because Jensen Biscotti. Yeah. I think Jensen and Biscotti just published their results assuming it was this source was elongated east-west. But this was known to be an assumption that was not very accurate. When I tried to correct my data for the first paper, I took the results that Jennison and Lathan were bringing out. I had probably not yet published, but it was eventually published.
Yeah.
As Jennison and Lathan. And I think, speaking from memory, I'd like to check the literature really. I think they probably had something like a position angle of 108 or 109. I think I got something like 112 or something like that.
I see. And you felt that was a significant difference?
It was significantly different. There was no doubt about that.
How many different spacings did you have?
I can't rightly remember. I had a number of shorter baselines. Where I just did transit observations in the north-south baseline. Then I had three long baselines in which I got round to this idea of following source. Started doing this, it wasn't continuous.
Oh, I see. So you had effectively many more because you were
tracking. I had many more. I started to track. It was a sort of quasi track. None of the arrows were driven electrically.
Oh, I see. So you move ahead and let it go through. Lots of
spot points.
Running over the fields, keeping ahead of the surface.
Yes, I had to use a bicycle. Backwards and forwards to keep setting the arrows. So, and that's how I got the position angle.
I see.
And once I got this new position angle, I could go back and analyse my old data. And then it's agreed with itself within its experimental errors where it had not agreed to with itself within the experimental errors before.
So, and also in the abstract, it says here that you found Cygnus A to be more elliptical than at longer wavelengths.
I guess that's a way of putting it, yes. I found the apparent separation between the two components to be bigger. And you remember I told you sort of 10 minutes ago that we expected the source to get smaller as we went to higher and higher frequencies, and it wasn't. It was getting bigger.
So what did you make of that?
Well, I just went back and checked my data very carefully, and I couldn't get out of it, you know. And I mean, I went back to the stage where I didn't do any analysis. I just had fringe amplitude against baseline length, measured in wavelengths, and I just plotted, I think, Mill's data and Jennison's data all on top of the same diagram, and then you could see that my first minimum in the transform was just coming at a shorter baseline.
Right.
You just couldn't beat it, you know. There was no question of interpretation. Right. Just plotted the raw results, and okay. The answer stood out.
Astrophysically, what did you or anyone else make of this?
Well, evidently, it was that the spectrum was varying across the source. That was the only explanation that we could make of it.
Mm-hmm.
That the outlying regions of the source had a spectrum. The inner regions of the source had a steep spectrum.
And during this time, what were people saying as to why in the world the radial blobs are out here and you had this small elliptical object in the center?
What were people saying about that? I think they were just mystified. I can't remember. Because I was very much taken up with some sort of idea myself, which might just possibly interest you. It turns out to be nonsense, but...
Yes.
That is the idea that it struck me as really very unreasonable there should be two blobs like that. And so I cooked up some sort of idea. Nobody measured polarization sources in those days. And so I cooked up some idea that this double source was quite unreasonable. The radio source itself couldn't be like that. Now, you remember the Cygnus radio source is very low galactic latitude.
Mm-hmm.
So I cooked up some sort of theory that, in fact, we were seeing double refraction in the interstellar medium.
Hmm.
You know, as though we were looking at Cygnus through a piece of calcite.
Right.
That's the sort of picture I had at the back of my mind. I said it's unreasonable that it should really be double. So, by analogy with the calcite, I said, well, maybe one blob of Cygnus is polarized perpendicular to the other blob.
Mm-hmm.
But my observations were being done with linear polarized arrows. And when I started following Source, more or less, Islam, had one component been polarized or polarized the other,
right.
It wouldn't have got this good fit,
right.
Unpolarized theory. So obviously they weren't linearly polarized, but I really hung on to this idea, I couldn't get it out of my system. So I said, well, maybe it's some sort of double refraction where one component is circularly polarized one way and the other component is circularly polarized the other.
Right.
So I couldn't really make new feeds. I hadn't got the workshop facilities to do that, because we were very short of workshop facilities, and probably always have been, probably always will be. And I couldn't sell this idea to the powers that be in order to get let them build up new copper fees. So I invented a quarter wave plate. Hemispherical quarter wave plate that sat between the feed and the dish.
Mm-hmm.
And you could then test this quarter wave plate by having its axis parallel to the vector, waiting till the source came through the beam, so you sort of about to get a fringe. Then you turn the quarter wave plate through 90 degrees so that its axis was perpendicular to the electric field, and you could watch the phase of the fringe jump by 90 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
So I then knew that the quarter wave plate was working. I then observed at a minimum in the transform of Cygnus and looked at first one circular polarization, and then the next day the other circular polarization with one arrow, leaving the other area linear.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, linear meant it was receiving two circuits.
Right.
So if you've circularized one area and your other area is linear, and you think that you've got two blobs of opposite ends of circular, you will look at only one blob.
Right.
So I tried doing that, looking at first one blob and then the other blob according to this theory. And the fringe amplitude should have come up to fringe amplitude, because it didn't.
Very
so interesting.
So is this talked about at all in your monthly notices?
No. Data? And
or your thesis?
It's never, it's in my thesis.
It's in your thesis.
But I never saw the light of day in literature.
Why could you not have worked with cross dipoles to do the circular polarization?
I guess the answer is I didn't think of it. The point is that we weren't. I could have done it if it would have been technically quite possible. Then what that would have done. That's a good point, isn't it? What that would have done, it would have phase advanced one component, and that's due to the phase. Phase retarded the other, it would have brought them to phase.
Mm.
That's interesting, isn't it? Didn't think of it.
Ryle and Vonberg had done this right after the war for solar radiation, and then they showed that indeed bursts were circularly polarized in 1946.
Yes.
There wasn't much of it after that, I think. People put quarter wave plates in front of dishes for solar work.
Yes.
It's the first time I've ever heard of quarter wave plates for non-solar work, though.
Very yes. Yes, yeah, well, they're odd, that. Yes, now, of course, that's the way we would do it, isn't it? I mean, it comes quite naturally now.
It's always easy to look back and retrospect.
That's right, yes, but no, I just didn't think of it. I think that's the only answer.
So, this was, you were occupied 5 years, like you say, with this project.
That's right.
And really not much else, I gather.
Just that. I mean, really starting from the bottom, doing all the technical stuff, then getting...
Before we switch to the longer baseline work, perhaps you could tell me, this was the time when the dish was coming in, came into service, I guess, just about in the middle of your...
Yes, towards the end of what I was doing. Yes.
Right. Was this influencing at all? Were you sort of aside from all of this?
I was aside from it all.
Yeah.
Yes, I was... quite sort of watertight point. It's just a nuisance to me, because they have heaps of ironwork and so on, I might want to put one of my own.
Right.
So it's the only effect it had on me.
Did it change the... But you say that it made it more difficult, though, for you to get assistance, at least.
I think that's
there
so,
was, there
yes.
was a lot of effort going into this dish.
Building feeds for it and receiving and so
right.
on. Yes, that's right. But at that stage, where the Mark I really started to soak up all the technical effort, I had virtually... built my equipment, I was just observing space and...
So you just made it.
Yeah.
Now, having finished your thesis, you decided to stay here, or...
Yes, though you put it all in a nice, clear, watertight sort of way, which is not really the actual situation. it was this decision, you see, should this 10-centimeter experiment continue or not? And so, of course, the question asked was, will the Mark I work at 10 centimetres? And I think we found out pretty soon that it wouldn't.
What were the design specs?
Ah, well, now that's the interesting thing about the Mark I, you see. Originally, it was designed to be nearly a metre wave dish. And while the Mark I was actually being built, I guess, I think one of Lovell's books will tell you better than I know, but as I remember it, as the Mark I was actually being built. The Hadrian
Lens discovered. No, that was discovered in 51. It was a bit earlier.
Yes, I see. Well, anyway,
it may still be that Lovell decided, well, look, we've got to get into this, because
that's
after
what
a couple
happened,
years
yes.
of the Dutch doing the galaxy, yes. one could see that this was a very useful technique.
Probably it, because, I mean, originally, if you look at the old drawings, not really, drawings of the Mark I, it's a very spidery thing, and traditionally it was to be used only at medium waves. It was just a steerable version of the old wire transit telescope. That's the original concept.
Really? That's interesting. Well, once again, like I say, I can check his work, but
yes.
at some stage, then the decision was made to make it work at 21 centimeters.
That's right, to redesign the bowl completely. What it actually looks like now is quite different to what we see in the early documents.
And I suppose that this greatly added to the cost.
Yes,
and
right.
maybe said to have contributed to the various difficulties.
It's a great to-do over cost and so on,
right.
some stage. Yes, that's right.
But I mean, that this, what I'm trying to get at is that this astrophysical decision, that 21 centimeters was important, and was part of what led to the difficulties.
Yes, I think it probably was.
Yeah. So, but then what happened actually when it was on site, could be tested? What was it good to?
Well, it was certainly a useful dish, ultimately, but I think it was only about half as good as a perfect dish. But people were a bit chary about saying how good it was, I think. it was well known that it had a good beam, a narrow beam. It had the full, resolution.
Right.
But there was a great deal of umming and ahhing about exactly what its efficiency was. It was certainly not better than half what you would have expected from a perfectly fitted dish.
30% or something.
Something like that. But it depended very much on just what sort of feed you use. And some parts of the dish are very good and some parts are very bad. And if you've got a feed which uses the good parts and not the bad parts, you do quite well. But I don't think you ever did better than 25% of the average vision. But it did have a narrow beam, and then it had a sort of a shelf, all the extra power, as you might say, gone into a sort of plateau.
Yeah,
so it had the resolution, but it didn't have the gain, and it was liable to confusion
I guess this does not directly involve you, but could you perhaps comment on how this influenced what could be done with the dish?
Well, I don't think it influenced very much, actually. I think there was lots that it could to do,
It couldn't be done as well as one.
Just couldn't be done as well, that's right. But I think the field was wide open those days, so there was no shortage.
But I guess it was clear that it could never work at 10 centimeters.
But the result was it was clear it could never be useful at 10 centimeters. There were slight problems about steering the 21 centimeters as well, actually.
Yeah.
So 10 centimeters was obviously not on at all. It just didn't bother to try. So once we discovered that, because we didn't have the Mark II in those days, there was no decent dish to enable me to increase my sensitivity. Parametric amplifiers were a very questionable quantity, even at 408 megs.
Mm-hmm.
So at 10 centimeters, there was no possibility of a parametric amplifier. So the experiment sort of, circumstances killed it. I don't think it was any decision to be taken.
Yeah.
It just sort of took itself.
Nothing more to do with small dishes.
That's right. Small dishes at 10 centimeters is the subject we worked out.
You've gotten the resources.
That's
could
right.
Be done, yeah.
Yes. We toyed with the idea of observing the moon, but there didn't seem to be an astrophysical reason for doing this. The sun was felt to be too complicated. I could see the sun, of course, sunspots. But this was felt to be very much a specialist job, and it was a specialization that John Gould didn't do. And solar work. And I'd have been out on a limb if I'd done that. I'd have been all by myself, no other people here to talk to or anything. So the decision sort of virtually took itself to discontinue that experiment. But by that time, I had quite a lot of sort of expertise on what you could do with microwaves.
Mm-hmm.
And I was possibly the only one at George who had that expertise. So I looked around to see where I could use it. And at about this time, the Palmer, Morris, I can't remember who else was.
Thompson?
No, Thompson had left. It was the Palmer-Thompson combine,
right.
As you remarked, but Palmer, Hanby, Brown and Thompson it had been on the long baseline interferometer, but Hanby, Brown got completely taken up with his searchlights and optical interferometer. Brown, Palmer and Thompson. Thompson had gone away, I think he'd gone to the States, and he's still in the States, working on the VLB,
The VLA.
VLA, that's what the name for, yes, right. So that's what had happened to Thompson. So Palmer was the only one remaining who had a student called David Morris, been around the world quite a bit since. Roy Allen was another person in that group. And they had built a lot of equipment for out stations and Mark 1 for use on 159 MHz, long baseline. But they'd really been defeated by this introduction of ITV.
I wasn't recording before.
Oh, I see, yes, right. That's the Henry Brown, Palmer, and Thompson system had used radio link baselines going out as far as the cannon fiddle. That wouldn't mean anything to you. It's the Saturn on the Pennines there.
It's the what on the Pennines?
It's a site, an outstation that used to be some perhaps 10 miles away on the Pennines to the east. The height was used to make, so we could use a single radio link. Hop. Not too much in the way of phase instability. And all the radio links associated with this, there's a local oscillator radio link, and there was a modulated, IF was modulated onto the local oscillator. I never really understood that system, to be honest. All the radio links were in the sort of ITV frequency, about 200-300 megs. And this was a band which had been cleared by the GPO for ITV, and we used it before ITV came along, you see.
But was then, was that knowingly?
We knew that we were doing it, and the GPO didn't, if you want to know the real answer. But don't go and publish that.
So you didn't have much cause to gripe.
No, that's
when,
right.
When ITV came in.
No, right. We'd just been caught out. Because it was thought to be to begin with, I think possibly. People didn't know whether it was an experiment that was going to work, I guess. And so they wanted to do it quickly, with minimum politics. And get an answer. And of course the answer was there was lots of data to be had.
And this was the first time that these radio links had been used over any more than...
I think Mills had done it in Australia, in a fairly limited kind of way.
Right,
I think we'd done it more than anybody else.
Right, but I was thinking in England anyway.
I think we were certainly the only people that done it in England.
You didn't have to worry about... This was the first time that you would have had to worry about applying to the post office and so forth to...
Yeah, we were really rather naughty in those days. We didn't used to bother the post office at all. We just used to make our own way.
You just looked at the allocations for a clear band.
That's right, yes. And we radiated such peculiar signals that the GPO never found us. So we've been a lot more careful since.
So ITV did come in. About what time was this? 1960s or something?
It would be something like 1960s, early 1960s, yeah. Or possibly it wasn't that the ITV came in, but we knew they were going to come in. I think that's a bit more like it.
Yeah.
And so, for just a short one-off experiment, it would have been all right to go on with this radio link. But we now began to see that we were going to set up for research classes for years. And on that sort of basis, you couldn't use an unsecure frequency like that.
What was the research plan at that time?
Well, I think the basic, how this all got started, the basic, rather simple-minded now, concept was this, that we had these discrete radio sources, as we called them, and the simple-minded question was, are they stars or are they nebulae?
Mm-hmm.
And the simple way of answering that question is that stars have diameters which are virtually unmeasurable, nebulae have diameters of minutes apart. So if you can just measure the diameter of these unknown radio sources, you will be able to distinguish between stars and nebulae.
Right.
So that's what the it started out by being, a simple...
When you say started out, what day would you say...
Yes, perhaps that's a good point. Perhaps I'm going back a bit too far.
Because there was a paper in the Observatory, which you may remember, by Bracewell, called Radio Stars and Radio Nebulae.
Yes.
And he, in fact, around 54 or so, he made the case, well, they're probably all nebulae.
That's right.
I don't know how well accepted this was, but it seems from the way you're talking that while you were a student that it wasn't clear at all.
It was clear as far as strong sources.
That's true, because they were the only ones that had been measured.
That's right.
They all turned out to be a few arc minutes.
That's right. And there was that group of three papers that occurred together in Nature.
Yes.
From Australia, Cambridge,
and Signals and Cass.
That's right. And so the clear answer there was that they were nebulae, sure not. Now, it's a bit difficult to know just what the philosophy was. I can't help feeling that really there were sort of two philosophies not fighting each other, but working together. One philosophy was this: are some of the weaker radio sources stars? And you'll find them by their personal diameter. But we were going on for a sort of a less specific idea, I think, that here we could measure a parameter of radio sources, i.e. the diameter. What range of diameters exists, and in particular, what is the smallest diameter that exists? Mm-hmm. I think this was regarded as a sort of valuable measurement in its own right.
Well, astrophysically, it's very important, of course, as the energy source and so forth.
Yes, that's right. So here we had a parameter. What range will this parameter exist over? And we knew some of the large diameters you could get in Cygnus X and so on a single dish. So we knew one end of the range of this parameter. We were setting out to find out what the other range was.
Right, right.
So that, I think, was one of the motivations of this radio link interferometer. And then again, we also had at the back of our minds the idea that we had this new these new things called radio sources, and we wanted to classify them. Brightness distributions and so on might help us to classify them.
Mm-hmm.
We were going over sort of, you know, the biologist's sort of frame of mind. That here we have something new. Can we divide it up into genera or whatever you call them?
Botanists also, astronomers are always being criticized for being botanists at heart or something like that.
That's right, yes.
Let me ask you about this term radio stars and radio sources. I was interested to see that your thesis... I'm sorry, it's not your thesis, it's Walsh's thesis, but... you use the term, I think, radio source. Yes, it's both your theses. You use the term radio source.
Yes.
And his was a year before yours. And yet, David Edge's thesis, the 3C survey in 59, is a survey of radio stars at 159 megahertz.
Yes, that's right. Now, which probably changed a bit later than we did to radio sources.
Is there any significance in this, do you think, as to the two groups are just different people in general in the field who are thinking about these things, or are the two terms just sort of interchangeable, like sort of like flux units and Janskis now? Or...
Yeah, I don't know. A certain amount of joking went on about it, but I don't think there's anything very serious.
What do you mean joking?
Well, I think we tend to sort of, research students sometimes, tend to sort of laugh a bit somehow that Cambridge still called them radio stars. After the diameter measurements have shown they're more likely to be radio galaxies.
I see. So there really was an association of that term with Cambridge, whereas up here, radio sources.
I think there was, in a very subterranean sort of way, you know, gossipy sort of way. I don't think it was taken seriously at all. But I think we all knew that we didn't really know what these weaker sources were. We wanted to find out. And we might have been wrong. Somehow we had the intuition that they were not stars. Somehow Cambridge were hanging on to the idea that they were stars.
Right. Well, this is important, but I think.
It was just an intuition. I don't think it was any substance.
But the intuition, of course, will guide how one goes about trying to find things out.
Yes. So we were prepared to use radio link interferometers using coherent observations. We had to anyway, from a synchronization point of view, rather than struggling to use a Henry Brown system and the transcontinental.
What about the Australians? Do you remember whether they were using sources or stars? I could, of course, check this, but.
I don't remember is the answer. I can't remember.
And also, it is true, is it not, that during these years of Palmer and you and Alan working on longer and longer baselines, that you had by far the longest baselines.
That's right.
Using during all this time.
Yes.
There was really no competition.
There was no competition, no. That's another.
Any thoughts on as to why this was?
No, it was a bit of a puzzle, really. Well, it's, we thought it must be something to do with technique, the technology. It was quite a technology, looking back on it, in valve days. It was all valve electronics.
Right.
And quite a lot of technical effort went into that technology. And I inherited quite a lot of it from Henry Brown, Palmer and Thompson. I inherited the physical insights.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual hardware was pretty largely rebuilt. But
by you, largely?
Yeah, I guess it probably was. Because that's what I was trying to, when I said it, but what I was saying was that when the 10 centimeter experiment came to an end, I felt I had a lot of technical know-how about how to use 10 centimeters, microwaves and so on. And I also had the idea that they wanted to send bandwidths of IF back, sort of megahertz bandwidth. And immediately I saw, looking at the way the radio spectrum was getting crowded, the one place where you could put megahertz bandwidths without people worrying too much was up in the microwaves.
Right.
So I built my own microwave radio link, which we used to goose stray a few miles away. It was a very low power microwave, radio link, about 100 milliwatts transmitted power.
100 milliwatts?
100 milliwatts, yes. at 10.7 centimetres again. It was just cannibalised, my old red astronomy stuff cannibalised, you see.
The post office certainly wouldn't get concerned about 100 milliwatts, would they? In any case.
Well, we didn't tell them, they never knew.
Right, but I mean...
It was bang in the middle of a radar man.
Yeah.
Because, my radio astronomy observations were made in a radar man.
Hmm.
And what happened there was that the actual radar pulse just saturated my IR, and I just had to cut the heads off.
Right.
And then all the space in between was good for radio astronomy.